my uncle was talking about this sort of hippie idea about the planets being born from the sun. And as each planet moves away from the sun over like billions of years or whatever, it begins to become habitable for a certain amount of time. I just texted him like 20 minutes ago and asked him to expand on this. He said that the sun essentially gave birth to the planets more or less like laying eggs, and that they gradually moved out from the sun, developing and maturing until they reached a zone where it was possible to sustain life. But eventually they moved too far out and or got worn out, lost their water and atmosphere, e.g. Mars. Life, at least in its more complex forms, was no longer possible. They could have seeded a new planet, e.g. Earth, in at least two ways. One, if they were advanced enough, they could have flown here. If not, space debris from the moon and other planets has landed on the Earth many times. It could have contained spores. Okay, then I asked them if this was his theory or if something that he heard somewhere. Where can I follow up? He said, it's possible that I read about this theory somewhere long ago. It's equally possible that I made it up myself, or perhaps it's ancestral memory. So we jumped from Mars. Does this make sense?
Yeah. So Mars at one point was in the sort of the Goldilocks zone, as it's called, where it's like perfect for the formation of life, and has, as time went on, has moved away from the sun. It's gotten colder. The, you know, has less solar radiation. Life sort of essentially started to die there, and life decided to kind of essentially jump to Earth to continue. We're Martians already.
Yes, or we're bonds of Martians.
Yeah, no, I actually haven't heard this before, but I've definitely heard theories where, because we know that Mars had an atmosphere and water, you know, over a billion years ago, that life on Earth didn't start until, you know, it's possible that life had started on Mars before Earth, and that Mars essentially seeded life to Earth through asteroid impacts and things like that, because some microbes can definitely survive space travel, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's one potential theory. You know, we've found asteroids from Mars that we have at some point said looks like they contain some kind of evidence of life, of bacterial life, tiny microbes that potentially could have been alive. You know, none of it is 100% proven, I think, but there was definitely theories like that. Again, I don't know about the sun laying the eggs, the planet eggs, part of the story, but you know, I definitely think it's possible. It's definitely a magical theory in the sense that it feels right in some way.
Anyway, what is this book that we were talking about?
Well, yeah, so I suggested this book, S-S-O-T-B-M-E, which means Sex Secrets of the Black Magicians.
Oh, that was going to be my first question. What on earth does that stand for?
It's written by this magician whose real name is Ramsey Dukes, but he has a magical name, Adamai Philotunus. Yeah, I think this book is fairly old. It's like from the late 60s, early 70s. 74, yeah, from 74. But yeah, but it's an interesting book and really made me think about magic and art and science and religion in really different ways. I read this for the first time maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And in a way, like, it's really stuck with me. I kind of like forgot about it. But then when I find myself writing about certain things, about language, about art and culture and various other topics, I realize after a while that I'm kind of reframing some of the sort of the magical theories that he's put forth in that book. They've really kind of stuck with me.
It had a big effect on me as well, I think. I have always tried to fight this magical thinking tendency in myself because it seems, I don't know, kind of girly and new agey. And this book sort of teaches you how to respect the magical thinking and to take it seriously instead of resisting it, using it as one of the tools of life. Things like synchronicity, and not about synchronicity being an actual magical fact or a message, but an interpretation you can use.
It's all about kind of efficacy and effect and the power of these things, the way they help us to structure the world, right? So I think that what's kind of interesting about it is it's not about, oh, it's magic versus science, it's science versus religion, art versus whatever. All of those modes of thought have their uses if deployed well or correctly or in an intentional way. Can produce effects that are useful and can be used by us for interesting, sort of better our lives or art or whatever it is that we're making, we're doing with ourselves.
Yes, seeing it as a aspect of like, well, I guess like with magical thinking, it made me realize I was kind of wasting my energy resisting this part of me that is superstitious. This part of me that is superstitious is essential for even survival. There's this intelligence that we have that's smarter or like quicker than all the logic or rationalism science that we've learned. I outlined this part that sort of describes what I'm saying. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please.
I suggest that the proper study of magic could help us to understand and use these primitive survival skills to better advantage. In our civilized world, we have demoted half our data processing abilities because their main value seems to be to cope with just the sort of sudden, unpredictable situations which we try to eliminate from our civilized world. Science is the process by which we try to eliminate the unpredictable. Magic is the process by which we try to woo the unpredictable, and it is a great way to restore value to these lost processing skills. The practice and study of magic can make us feel a lot less silly about feelings and hunches. So in this case, he's talking about, well, he's describing a woman. Let me just read this. Consider the lone woman opening the door to a slightly scruffy stranger who claims to be from the waterboard. She senses something is wrong and has what she describes as a bad feeling about the man, and she can respond in several ways. One is to shut the door in his face and ring the police. Another is to argue with herself that she should not be such a silly, prejudiced woman and then let him in without further question. My point is that her bad feeling is an immediate sense that the situation, the man, her alone, the request to enter the house, is a pattern which, quote, unquote, goes with danger. My argument is that this process deserves more respect than it sometimes gets. In the second behavior option, the lady calls this process prejudice and overrules it. Because we are trained to value reason more highly than feeling, reason tends to step in and analyze these feeling judgments, e.g., dear me, why am I feeling insecure just because the man's shoes are a bit tatty and he looks a bit scruffy? I'm becoming as middle class and prejudiced as my mom. Reason can nearly always analyze a number of components of any pattern and often is used to dismiss them. E.g., scruffy shoes could simply mean poverty, dirty hands could simply mean that he has been turning off a stopped cop in the street, a shifty look could simply mean he is awkward about asking a lone woman to let him into the house, and so on, until the initial sense of danger begins to look like unthinking prejudice. My argument is that this pattern recognition process is not so stupid. I believe we have it because it has as much survival value as logical thought. In cases of immediate danger, of very rapid decision-making, it is actually far more useful than the pedestrian process of logical thought. The reason we value logic so much more highly is largely because civilized society allows fewer such immediate threats than our animal past. And so we have forgotten the value of such feeling. We get the point across?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the aspects here is the kind of the rapid judgment, the rapid sort of pattern recognition that our minds have, that we tend to dismiss for a variety of reasons. We're mashed together in, you know, big cities. There's a lot of us here, and we have to figure out how to live together. But at the same time, this is this new technological society which tries to get rid of all the dangers that we would normally face in, say, in our ancestral hunter-gatherer lives. Maybe they still exist, but just in a very different way. And we are still attuned to those things, but now we dismiss them because we feel like we've left the forest, we've left the cave, we've left the plains that we used to roam as nomads, and now we're safe in these places. You know, I'm not trying to say that we should be afraid of all the other people or whatever. Like the example is maybe a little heightened in terms of like, oh, it's dangerous to let somebody into the house. But also, you know, there's other things. There's like cars. There is, you know, there's the kind of built environment that we exist in. There is computers. There's all these kind of smaller things that exist around us that we invite to our homes unthinkingly and are told that these are tools of civilization, tools of progress, tools of the enlightenment, so to speak, and we should embrace them. But at the same time, our minds can sometimes resist that. And sometimes maybe it's important to listen to that, to that resistance.
Like ideally, the whole person is able to embrace both feeling and logic at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing that is interesting that sort of follows on all this is what I really liked in the book personally is his idea of the sort of the cycles, the mental cycles through. So, you know, he shows four different types of ways of thinking. So there's art, there's religion, there's science, and there's magic. And then these also correspond not just to kind of ways of thinking, but also to successive periods of thought where certain kinds of modes of thought become dominant. So there's religious form, which maybe existed sort of post the Roman Empire to present more scientific mode of thought, which has been kind of in ascendance since the Enlightenment. And now we're maybe entering a new kind of magical age, partly because of the way science and technology have fragmented the self and the sort of the pre-existing structures that were built up over you know, millennia and centuries. And we're kind of finding ourselves in a new jungle, so to speak, techno jungle, where the things that are sort of available to us, the things that we interact with, have almost magical properties that outstrip our ability to keep up with. So magical thinking, magic is a way to cope with that and a way to comprehend it in a way that maybe the scientific mind cannot.
Mm-hmm. Because science is over our heads in a way. So we have to sort of fill in the gaps.
I don't know if it's over our heads. It's more, you know, science, at least the way Dukes defines it, is a more constrained look at the world. It's looking through a more focused lens. So it becomes, you're only looking at things that make sense from the scientific point of view, and you have to drop out any data that doesn't fit.
Mm.
So when you're thinking about something in a scientific way, you have to exclude other things. So like, if you're formulating a scientific theory about anything, but it makes you feel a little weird, you have to exclude the feelings. The theory is the most important thing. This is science. This is the thing that exists in reality. And your feelings are not really important in this case. Science kind of excludes those things. So, you know, magic kind of brings back all that extra stuff. So science produces a certain effect in your feelings, but your feelings also matter in that sense.
So does magic use science?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, I think Ramsey Dukes also kind of talked about that. You can definitely, you know, magic is very much a huge bucket of things, right? So there's feelings, and it can use whatever tools it has in its possession to create magical effects. So scientific tools are definitely something that can be used. Science and alchemy have been intertwined for a long time, and they were essentially, you know, the same discipline. So physical effects and effects that are produced outside of those basic physical effects, or so to speak, magical effects, are also, you know, part of that. Magic and alchemy have over, you know, millennia kind of informed each other in many ways. I think he had a really nice example of sort of like, you know, magic at some point started taking on, or at least occult practices that started to use scientific terminology. So like magnetism, ether, things like that, where they were kind of taking scientific concepts and trying to explain some potential occult phenomena. And I think that's kind of continued. There was science fiction sometimes takes magical concepts and creates science fictional stories around them, because there is that, I think it's kind of porous. They're kind of, both of those concepts can kind of inform each other. They kind of annoy each other, but they can also inform each other in many different ways. Arthur C. Clarke, I don't know if you've heard this phrase, but he always said that magic is indistinguishable from sufficiently high technology. So like when something is super high tech, it essentially becomes indistinguishable from magic.
Okay, I just found this passage that illustrates your point. That was in reference to something you said earlier. Some new technologies confound mechanistic analysis. Observation and logic are fundamental to scientific thinking. If you left an intelligent person alone on a desert island with a clock or a steam engine and a few spanners, they could eventually discover how it worked. But the same is not true of a silicon chip. Whereas a previous generation felt it necessary to be able to understand how domestic appliances work, and how to repair them, We increasingly are driven to accept that things either work or they need to be replaced. Learning to accept unexplained phenomena in this way is good training for magical thinking. Here is an example. As a Fortran programmer in the 1970s, if a program did not work, I would return to the source code and analyze it for errors. In the 1990s, this is no longer practical. Instead, I phone a helpline and am told there is a bug, which means I should try to avoid certain sequences of activity. This is analogous to being told that it is unlucky to walk under ladders. There are two factors here driving evolution towards magical thinking. Increasing complexity, as in the second example, plus commercial pressure, which forbids access to the source code, as in the third example.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we're essentially, technology's gotten to the point where no single person can know how that one thing works. So like your phone is really more, it's closer to some kind of magical orb that you purchase through an offering of gold. And now you have the powers of this orb for a while. And then at some point, the power of the orb will dissipate, and then you have to get a new orb, maybe more advanced orb, maybe it has more powers or whatever, but can't repair it. You know, there's a point in time where it becomes obsolete. It no longer has the power that it used to have through various reasons, like maybe the battery gets drained and doesn't work anymore, and you can't easily get that fixed, or the operating system becomes so old that the newest operating system can be installed on the present chip. So then the power of this device is no longer, you know, as it used to be. So now you have to get a new powerful device.
Or your belief in it has simply flagged and you need to believe in something new.
Right, because you've been watching TV commercials and they show you that the new iPhone is so much better. you've been programmed to get the new orb. Our interactions with these things have become a lot more magical than they are scientific. We call up certain programs, we don't understand how they work, but we just call them up through a sequence of finger movements, or we talk to the phone. And if you ever see a person on the street kind of talking to their phone, sometimes you're not sure if they're a crazy person or if they're just someone talking to their phone, you know? And that's really kind of changed our interactions with technology. We're no longer participants. We're more users. We're more people who have to somehow, we're more users of magical devices rather than users of technology. In a weird way, just in the way we interact with it.
Okay, so there's science / technology as magic, but then there's also science technology as religion. So this logical thinking has taken over. We don't have a cohesive belief in anything but science and logic. And so that has become our religion. I heard the other day, I hear this, I think it was Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, they said, trust the science in terms of vaccinations. And they say it with such conviction, trust the science. And I was reading this book while I heard that, and I was thinking that they were not really talking about science in a scientific way, but they were talking about it more in a religious way, because we don't know if the quote unquote science is working. Like, science is theories. Like, we don't know.
Yeah, there's two ways that works. Like, religion tends to be dogmatic and hierarchical. You kind of have a system and you believe in it and you affirm it. Science broke down the old religion because it showed that certain things that old religion was affirming didn't work anymore. So science broke that whole thing down and became a new paradigm, kind of emerged from that. At first, it was scientific in a sense that you trusted the science. There was a scientific method. Everybody was kind of on board with it. And I think what's weird about now, and I think in the old days, you rarely would have somebody say, like, trust the science. You would just be like, hey, check out this new invention. Look at this new invention. Look at this new thing that's improving the world. And now we're kind of in this weird new pattern where scientists have to affirm that science works. And partly, I think, is because the trust in science has eroded on some level, you know, through some of the processes we talked about earlier, that we, you know, we're kind of in this place where science has become so complex and so endemic that it's becomes harder and harder to trust it implicitly. And also it has become so contaminated with various other, through politics, through commerce, through other kind of entities that use science for their specific purposes. So obviously, you know, science is responsible for vaccines, but it's also responsible for like nuclear weapons, right? It's also responsible for, you know, huge industrial accidents and pollution, all these other things. So when you say trust the science, there's a lot of baggage that comes with that. And it becomes much more of a dogmatic phrase. In this case, maybe, yes, you should trust the science. But in so many other cases, if you say trust the science, the evidence just isn't there.
My feeling about it is that we don't know, like, religion is faulty and science is faulty. We don't know. We can't see the whole picture. As humanity, we have to sort of be on the same page. And so we all have to kind of rally around something, which is basically a grand experiment. I'm sure the vaccinations are fine, but we all have to sort of willingly trust something, even though it's starting to seem sinister and mysterious.
Right. This kind of formula also plays out in other ways. Like, you know, for example, global warming, right? So, you know, we have scientists telling us the planet is heating up, you know, there's climate issues, climate change is happening, you know, due to human activity. And it's true, like, that's what's happening. And they say, trust the science, this is happening. But at the same time, it's also happening because of science. The scientific revolution, the industrial revolution that has gotten us here is also the cause. The science is both the cause and maybe potentially the salvation here. For a long time, science was telling us, no, this is the way the world should be. Let us build these amazing cities. Let us power them with beautiful lights and screens and things. And all of a sudden, over the last 30 years, it's like, wait a minute. We're doing something wrong here. Let's let science tell you that something else is happening. Over time, as you kind of live in this, you know, multiple stages of this scientific technological civilization, you start to wonder, like, okay, well, 30 years ago, they were saying this, now they're saying this. What do I trust? Who do I trust? You know, and maybe if you're a trained scientist, read the science, you understand the numbers and you understand the data. But even the, so to speak, big data that we're surrounded with, you know, like the data that gets collected by Google, by Facebook, by, you know, all these huge entities, that data can be read and interpreted in so many different ways. And certain entities want this data to be interpreted in this way. Other entities want the data to be interpreted in this way. So then it's like, we don't ultimately know what the right interpretation is and whose interpretation should we trust. So, you know, so in a way, like, it's understandable that humans would start to kind of look to other ways of interpreting stuff, other ways of finding meanings. Meaning is not just a scientific theory. Meaning is like a scientific theory, but why? And why? And, you know, like, so, you know, Ramsey Dukes had a lot of interesting things, like, you know, he was talking about, you know, driving and like hitting a bird, you know, this technological marvel, the car destroyed this little bird. And for him to sort of to find meaning in that was to treat that as a sacrifice, think about the bird as a sacrificial being and that it died for a reason. Another way of thinking about magic is like to find the meaning behind all these things, or find meaning in this meaningless existence, so to speak.
Magic is more interpretive than, and science is not enough and not a thing to hang all your trust on.
Well, I mean, that certainly seems to be the way we're going, you know, whether you personally believe that or not. I think that's something that you can see that in the world, people being kind of skeptical of larger narratives, scientific, religious, political, et cetera, et cetera. Did I derail this too far over?
No.
The other kind of interesting for me as an artist, as a cartoonist, you know, that's interested in magic in some ways. And I'm interested in science too. You know, I mean, I'm interested in both of these things, but I'm interested in the kind of when they intersect as well. But in comics, you know, there's at least over the last 30 years, there's been a pretty solid tradition of magic being used as a way to create narrative, as a kind of a divinatory tool to kind of figure out where the story goes. I mean, Alan Moore is famous for thinking about art and magic in a similar fashion. Grant Morrison created sort of magical rituals while he was writing some comics and trying to kind of set things in motion. There's some correspondence there between art and magic.
Is that like, I think it was Brian Eno and someone that created the oblique...
Oblique strategies, yeah, the card deck.
Is that a sort of magic?
Yeah, that can be seen as a divinatory tool of sorts, kind of like a tarot deck or something, you know, where you have predetermined, you know, there's a finite number of strategies within a deck or symbols or whatever it is that you have in the deck. And then you draw them at random and you perform that thing. And And then randomness helps you deal with the randomness of the world.
Because you have a structure, but you also have the randomness.
Right, right, right.
The structure is very important. Like any artist will tell you, you need some kind of structure to work within.
And, you know, and magical structures, tarot divination, things like that have been used by many artists, you know, help them get through a project. But even science, I think, is in many ways very much, at least some scientists are very interested in magic, or at least in the potential of magic. There's a lot of crossover between them, like Jack Parsons. Did you ever read about Jack Parsons, the rocket scientist, NASA rocket scientist, or this was maybe pre-NASA, I'm not sure, but he was kind of an acolyte of Aleister Crowley and was into magic, into Thelema, the system of Thelema that that Aleister Crowley created. And he's this very much founding member of American space program. And there's other examples, you know, like right now, currently, a lot of tech people are into the idea of the holographic universe, that we're maybe all living inside of a simulation. And in a way, that's kind of a magical theory using scientific language where, you know, there's too many weird coincidences and correspondences that happen for it to be random, you know? So it has to be, there has to be some kind of code underneath it that's creating all this stuff. And that's a popular theory in you know, kind of the tech world. So there's a lot of bleed through that happens. And sometimes the search for some kind of magical tool also powers scientific discovery because they, you know, they want to be able to communicate across large distances, which seems like a magical act, but now is very common. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting how magic can be kind of foil for science, but also an inspiration and for art.
I prefer to think of it as patterns more than code. Codes seem predetermined, whereas it seems like there's some kind of pattern happening that's playing out.
Yeah, but isn't pattern a kind of a repetition? So isn't code, if you...
Pattern would be a repetition, but it would be constantly changing and, well, more chaotic, more random.
But then it wouldn't be a pattern if it was too chaotic. There wouldn't be a pattern, right? Like pattern would have to, there has to be repetition for something to be a pattern. Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, but if the pattern incorporates other things, and then it becomes...
Yeah, for sure. No, there has to be... I mean, you can see a pattern in difference. Like, there's different things happening, but there's something similar about them. But that's what I mean. Like, the repetition, there has to be something repeating for you to recognize it as a pattern. Otherwise, there's no pattern, even if it's in different contexts.
Big for my...
I don't know if I have a good example. You know, it's weird because there's black magic and then there's magic. Mm-hmm. So black magic, you can think of as the programming part. So when you're saying it's too pre-programmed, you can think of that as black magic, like programming someone to perceive something that maybe...
So black magic is basically manipulating people or others for nefarious...
Yeah, you can definitely see it that way. There was a great book called Snow Crash. I don't know if you ever read that. It's probably out of your wheelhouse. It's a science fiction book, but it's kind of a cyberpunk book. But what's interesting about that book, talking about programming languages, but then it also talks about the human language as having some kind of underlying base programming code that was discovered millennia ago by the Babylonians. And that's
still kind of thinking of comparing the human to the computer and having the human be programmable in the same way. Anyway, the Babylonians.
There's a thesis in that book, and again, it's a science fiction book, but there's a thesis that civilization maybe started because someone discovered a way for us to think the same, for all of us to kind of to focus in on a single thing, on a single...
Yeah, we all trust the science.
So we focus in on this single thing, whether that's a religion, whether that's science, whether that's, you know, some kind of national identity or tribal identity or something like that. So there was someone who kind of figured out how to do that at some point in time. And then the Tower of Babel story is the breakup of that. So at some point, humanity kind of came together under a single system that was essentially using the base human code to program us to believe in this particular thing, meaning we just were like part of some kind of early civilization that was all one thing. And then the Tower of Babel broke it up. The system broke up. We forgot that original code, and now we kind of are off into our own different things. things. So the book posits that there's something like that underneath everything. And there, you know, there's some scientific theories. I think Noam Chomsky even talks about some kind of genetic-based language that maybe exists that undergirds all languages. Anyway, so then magic could be a way to kind of activate that, to activate certain regions, hidden regions in the mind that can be activated through magical ways of talking, like neuro-linguistic programming or something, where you prime people for certain kinds of things, whether that's for them to give up their money to you, or whether they would buy your products, or whether they would worship the gods or become part of some kind of cult or something like that. There is some kind of dark magic that can be performed linguistically or through images or through imagery that could sway you into some kind of cult-like following.
I mean, I think that there is like the idea that people are sort of fragmented. Different people think different ways and they're all going in their different mental directions. Babel story. I think that each person is fragmented in that way. We're divided inside of ourselves, which I think is... People talk a lot about trauma, but it's like there is some kind of traumatic thing that happens that we ourselves, are different parts of ourselves, are separated from ourselves. So, and are not really communicating or on the same page. So we have these conflicting desires and we do things to sort of undermine ourselves. And in the same way, us as a people are doing that too. We're all thinking in different ways and conflicting in that way.
Yeah, no, there are a number of sort of psychological or psychiatric theories where the complete self, the whole self, doesn't really exist in those theories, that we are just a series of conflicting impulses. And sometimes they become personalized, like the multiple personality disorder. You would have, they sort of acquire personalities, become different selves, so to speak. And then, you know, the same thing happens in societies. Like there was a study done, I don't remember what that was, but they were studying villages in the Amazon where at some point the small kind of society that would be in this small little village would enter a conflict phase where some of the people would just have to leave and create their own society. Mm-hmm. So there was a conflict that would be created, and the way to resolve the conflict was to remove the conflict makers, and they would go off on their own and start their own village somewhere else. And then that would just continue, like these villages.
Their religious sect breaking off.
You can think of modern society in a similar way. Like right now, we're kind of in a way, we're living through some of these conflict moments where, like, if you think of our scientific and technological civilization, is our wonderful Tower of Babel created out of human hubris and rationality. That is falling apart, and we're kind of going in different directions, politically, theologically, and magically, coming up with new ways of coping with that.
Are we really, though? I mean, is it just that it appears that we're all going in different directions? It seems like we all kind of exacerbated. Like we're kind of exacerbated by the internet, for example. Like we just have like a billion conflicting points of view, but we've always had those zillion conflicting points of view. It just hasn't been online.
I know, but that's the Tower of Babel. Now we have the Tower of Babel and we can see all those conflicting points of view. Whereas before, maybe they were just simmering underneath and all you saw was, you know, the television, the news that was all kind of flattened and didn't really admit a lot of different voices. And now through the internet, through social media, through all those different channels, we can see the multiplicity of voices and it's all kind of coming out in the primal scream of the internet, you know, which is essentially the Tower of Babel tearing itself apart.
I can't help but see that as a good thing.
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's happening. You know, like to me, it's, I'm not trying to sort of like moralize about it. I'm just saying it's happening. And I think it's interesting to think about it and follow it to wherever it leads. One way to react against it is to just try to bottle it up, to say like, no, let's hide that stuff. Like we don't want that. You know, we want to just be able to trust one thing. And that's the thing that we should be trusting because that's the thing that keeps us together. And the other way is to say like, hey, maybe we need to like figure out how to split up, but stay together. I don't know what that means, but definitely a certain sort of political and global consensus is like fraying right now. You know, maybe we'll figure out a way to stitch it back together. But the world post-World War II has definitely sort of fallen apart and is really mutating in a way that is uncertain right now where that's going to go. part of that is the scientific consensus. Part of it is the international world order. This part of it is this whole pandemic has really like heightened a lot of the divisions and the things that were kind of maybe already happening, but we just didn't see them happening. But the pandemic has really brought them out.
Yes.
And it's all because of magic.
Can you say that the internet is just like a mind becoming aware of itself and its own thoughts?
Maybe. I mean, maybe this is, you know, maybe the internet is kind of the first time we have access to what certain mystics in the past called the collective unconscious or the noosphere, the N-O-O sphere, where human minds can start interacting with each other directly and create some kind of mental space where we, you know, we all coexist as a kind of collective mind. But at the same time, that was kind of the ideal. But what the reality of that collective mind may be really, you know, what we're experiencing right now is like, it's not just this wonderful thing where we're all coexisting and seeing each other's thoughts, but it's also the horror of that, of seeing everybody talking about the food they like, that we hate, thoughts in the moment that people have on social media that we don't like, or just the absolute multiplicity of humanity that we sometimes maybe recoil from because it's just so huge. And we have to contend with everybody's little thoughts, little things like, I'm depressed right now. Look at me. I've bought a new pair of shoes. Look at me. Like, I made a drawing. Look at me. I made a video. Look at me. I made this. And like, it's just this cacophony of things that is more, that maybe pulls us apart in some ways into these smaller units.
Yeah, my inclination is that maybe we have to be pulled apart in some way. Like, that's what happens when you, like, we ourselves are cacophonous. And
exactly. So like, you know, if we already know that we ourselves are that way, then the global mind will be us, but like to billionth degree.
But it's us to a billionth degree, isn't it? It's just like a bigger us, like a bigger...
Exactly. So if we're already neurotic and divided and a little crazy, imagine the planet neurotic, divided and a little crazy.
I still see healing in that. I see when we become aware of how we begin to heal, when we're able to see our own patterns and experience them. Like, we can still feel them and work, we'll still do them, but the beginning of healing is just simply being aware of them. And we'll keep going through these patterns until we exhaust ourselves. And it feels like the internet can do that too. Collectively, we are evolving, although it's just confoundingly slow and invisible. I had this idea of social media is the default network system of our brain. Yeah, it's the part of our mind that is just constantly, that just won't shut up. It's just like all that stuff you were saying. This is what I ate today. This is how I'm feeling right now. And just like blah, blah, blah. And the reason we have this default network system is to keep ourselves awake, to keep ourselves going. And like in meditation, we're trying to quiet ourselves down. We're basically trying to quiet the default network system. But we really fight that because what's underneath the default network system is more scary stuff. The more we quiet it ourselves down, the more the other stuff comes up.
We're approaching the dark night of the soul, but in global terms, in global social terms.
I think so. Like, we have to go through it all. We can't just stop it. We have to just keep watching it play out.
Yeah, I don't know if you read, I wrote this. This was an indicia of Cartoon Dialectics number one. I kind of wrote this thing. I was just trying to be cheeky, but I ended up getting kind of serious. I said, we're also on social media, meaning us, meaning like Uncivilized Books or whatever. But I recommend against finding us on social media. It's better to avoid the internet altogether. It is a cesspool of nonsense, insult, narcissism, and hurt feelings. Why on earth would you do that to yourself? It's mankind's greatest invention. It's huge. We built it to communicate with each other. It even works wirelessly, the whole planet, to accomplish this task. It's seriously impressive. What we didn't realize is that we built a nervous system, not a communication system. So the internet is, like you say, it's less of a communication system. It's more like a raw nerve. It's the first like global raw nerve of humanity. And all we're seeing right now is like overpowered. It's like, it's constantly on. We're almost like torturing ourselves with it because we keep hitting it, you know, the same buttons over and over and over again. And it's like touching the raw nerve of humanity, and quieting it down means either stepping away from it or figuring out a new way of being with it, you know? And like you say, maybe that's what we're approaching right now, is a dark night of the soul, the darkness that lurks within that. Because the internet is so young and new, we are kind of, we kind of have to experience it for the first time, and it's a very scary place.
I think of like when I go on the internet and I'll like go look something up, and then I'll get distracted and I'll go down some rabbit hole, as they say. But that's the same way my mind works. Like if I try to think about something, I go down a rabbit hole. My self-control with the internet is as weak as my self-control with my mind. But I do think that swimming around in that chaos is also important. I like to go and see what the memes are of the day and like what everyone is talking about, what all the kids are talking. I like to take a little swim every day in the chaos of the social media.
The difference, the way I see it, is, you know, there's a difference in the way you get lost in your own mind versus the way you get lost in the internet. In the internet, you get lost in whatever kind of being thrown at you. So you stumble onto something and you follow that through line. In a way, that tunnel is kind of built for you. And a lot of times it's algorithmically built for you, right? Some algorithm is feeding you this stuff because, you know, you're like, oh, this is interesting. You click on that link. The algorithm goes, oh, Gabrielle likes these links. I'm going to give her more of these links. So like something is amplifying your reality tunnel on the internet. It's not just this kind of pure coincidence of stumbling onto these things. It's much more circ to you.
I don't think that there's any difference. Like in your own mind, you're also programmed by all the things that have happened to you, your associations, your memories. I think it's kind of the same thing.
Sure. But in that sense, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying, like, when you're away from the algorithm feeding you this, at least you're your own algorithm instead of Google being the algorithm. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe I'm being prejudiced here against, you know, Google's algorithm. Feels different. It feels different when you're kind of on your own in quiet 2 hours ruminating versus online following a rabbit hole at the end of the online kind of session.
Well, maybe you're less neurotic than me.
Maybe. After like 2-3 hours of doom scrolling on the internet, you feel wrecked in a way. Whereas sitting around for 2 hours thinking about something feels more restorative in some ways. I don't know. I can definitely feel anxious sometimes and just feel really burnt out by sitting there quietly and not knowing what to do. But that's part of boredom. Boredom is like something that is also generative, you know, like it makes you want to do something because you don't want to be stuck in your head.
I'm stuck in my head.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm just trying to make a comparison here. Like, that's one way to think about it. I'm not saying that's the only way. I mean, I'm sure there's people who live on the internet and it's actually a nice thing to kind of go down these rabbit holes.
I feel like us as Generation Xers who came to the internet a little bit later will always see it as like a thing that's other. Like the millennials and the Zoomers, they tend to integrate it more seamlessly into their lives. Whereas I didn't really get online until I was in my 20s. It's always been this sort of foreign thing. Like, and of course, some people are more adept at it, but in a way, it's like a language. Like some people are very talented at languages, and others like myself are very clumsy with languages. It's not so much a second language to the younger people. It's just like their first language. Whereas for us, we will always be sort of stumbling.
Yeah.
I'm seeing it as this other thing and not as just another thing to navigate.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that we're not digital natives in a way, where we kind of came to it later in life. But at the same time, we remember the world pre-internet, and we remember, like, I remember the early internet because I was on it pretty early, like in the early 90s, before you had Google, before you had AOL in a big way, before you had Yahoo and all the kind of search engines that essentially curate the internet for you. It was just a bunch of websites, you know, and you kind of had to figure out how to find them. Sometimes somebody would email you something. Sometimes you would find out from a friend. Sometimes you stumble on some links on someone's website and follow them. It was less curated, more of a kind of a wild west where you had to discover things. And you had to also learn the programming language. You had to learn how to interact with it on a lower level than we do now.
But people say it's the wild west now.
I don't know if it's the wild west anymore. It's the Google west.
In terms of like people are cruel and it's like lawless and that you could just like find anything, I guess, in terms of there not really being it.
It's nowhere near the Wild West it used to be. I mean, right now you have like algorithmic curation where, you know, YouTube, Twitter, etc. will shut down your site for specific words or specific phrases or specific things, for good or ill, will do that. Whether you're guilty or not, it'll shut your site down and, you know, you have to like, it's definitely a lot more police than it used to be. It used to be like awful. And it was either like just a bunch of friends, so it was fine, or it was just like this free-for-all without any moderation.
Would you say it's like a police state now, the internet?
For sure. I think the internet right now is a lot more policed, and it's not just the algorithms that are policing you. There's Twitter. A lot of users are like reporting other users, you know? It's like, and again, like I'm not going to render judgment here, but that's like Eastern Europe, Stasi level, where neighbors are listening on neighbors and reporting them to the authorities for whatever reason, you know, like whether that's good or bad. And they do it willingly. And
it's coming from within, like we're policing ourselves.
Yeah, it's definitely much more of a policed, the internet. And it feels more constrained. You no longer just go kind of like randomly to places. You start at Google, you start at Facebook, you start at Twitter. And then those places, you know, maybe take you somewhere else.
Speaking of being taken somewhere else, have we gotten a little far from the theme of magic?
In a way, that's magic too. You know, it's like creating perceptions and narratives, creating effects in the world through linguistic tricks.
Maybe.
But yeah, we have strayed from magic as a primary thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, again, like it's the world we're in a way, it's more constrained because it has these large entities like Google, like Facebook, like Twitter, that comprise so much of our sort of online life. In real life, we also have other entities like, you know, whatever, the governments and science, you know, all these things are kind of very monolithic and can't really imagine them being gone in any way, shape or form, except through like almost apocalyptic endings. And that's also like magical thinking in a way, because magic is a way to navigate a world that you can't control. We're kind of in that world, you know, we're in that world where nobody can just say, hey, I'm going to change how Google works. Nobody can say change how the government works. Nobody can say change how science works. So you have to create these other ways of coping with that.
So what are these ways?
You know, like I said, magic just helps us find that meaning, right? I mean, I don't know. I'm not a magician, so I don't have all the answers, but that's how I see it. I see it as a way to find meaning in meaninglessness, to find meaning in things that we can't control. You know, maybe we can control some small subset of these things in a more constrained way.
Like using social media or the algorithm to put our art out there and connect with other people.
You know, memes are kind of this whole idea of like meme magic, you know, where you create a meme and you try to create an effect in the world through the spread of that meme. I think technology can be used, like we said earlier, you know, we can use the language of technology, we can use technology, magical effects in a way that maybe is not originally intended.
Mm. Okay, do you have anything to say about the magic of NFTs?
NFTs and have non-fungible tokens. I don't know. Like, I mean, you know, right now everybody is like really upset about NFTs, and I think for all the wrong reasons. I mean, there's talk about the energy impact on these things, et cetera. And I looked.
What is the energy impact?
Well, this gets really technical. You have to kind of talk about the blockchain technology, which is the technology that kind of undergirds all the kind of cryptographic currencies. And NFTs are essentially like unique versions of those cryptographic currencies. They require a lot of power to sort of both to generate new blocks of those cryptographic.
I'm just going to have to really break this down. What kind of power does it take?
I think the latest estimates were, you know, it was roughly the equivalent of the power of Argentina to run like Bitcoin and all the other kind of cryptographic currencies together. So each NFT is a single instance of that. It sits on top of other cryptographic currencies like Ethereum, for example. And Ethereum is very high power intensive as well. So minting one of those is intensive because it has to be replicated on multiple servers all around the world to create the chain of validations for this object or this virtual object.
This is very interesting.
I've been kind of in the cryptographic space a little bit, and myself, I've read a lot about it. I've read a lot of the papers, and you know, and they are very power hungry. But like the comparisons that people are making, I think, are not one to one. So, for example, like you know, like a Visa transaction is not the same as like a cryptographic transaction. Like the comparison maybe is more towards like an international money transfer to a single crypto transaction rather than like a single swap of a Visa card or whatever. So I think that they don't have the power dynamics right. The criticisms don't. That said, you know, I don't know if you've seen any of the NFTs, but they're not that interesting. You know, they are very like very much cultural artifacts from a very specific corner of the internet. So like there's this sort of coin world of the internet, and they have their own kind of cultural touch points, and they have their own cultural ideas about, you know, how the world works. And a lot of that artwork speaks to that in a very specific way. And, you know, when you look at it from outside, it feels like dumb and stupid and like uninteresting. You're gonna just dismiss it. At the same time, it's like it's an interesting technology. I don't know where that's gonna go. It's really kind of in its infancy. I mean, I think Bitcoin was created in 2008, which, you know, it's a very young technology. It's only like 12 years old. I think it, you know, there's a lot of potential there. This is gonna get into like monetary policy, but like we've already like devalued money in the 70s, where we kind of went off the gold standard. Like it used to be that money was like gold.
Yeah.
You could go into the bank with your money and say, give me the equivalent in gold, and you would get that. We went off that standard. So now money is just kind of free floating and created by the power and the trust in whatever country is minting this money. And there's more and more of it minted all the time. In a way, it's already virtual, right? So kind of moving that into some kind of electric cryptographic global currency is actually kind of interesting. And it's actually more transparent than the money that we have now, because right now, very small amount of people control what's going on with that money. Whereas with, say, Bitcoin, you know exactly what every transaction is because it's on the blockchain. You can look up every transaction. So it's more transparent.
Do you have cryptocurrency?
I have some Bitcoin, yes. I was on the internet from a very early time, like in the early 90s. And I was, you know, I know how to program. I know how I'm interested in the internet. There was a moment in time where I kind of got burned out with the internet and I stepped away from it. But I was there like when Bitcoin was created in the early days. I actually ran a Bitcoin miner for a while. And just to like, I was just like curious, like, what is this thing? What is this thing called, you know, Bitcoin? I have no idea what it is. I think I've minted probably a few coins. I've lost them all. If I had them now, I would be like a rich guy. But I minted some Bitcoin. I don't even remember how much, if it was like a full Bitcoin or if I just had like a few Satoshis, which is like a subdivision of Bitcoin. So I'm interested in technology. Like one of the more interesting kind of uses of it right now is Brave browser. I don't know if you know about the Brave browser, but it has its own cryptocurrency called the BAT, the Basic Attention Token. So they're essentially trying to eat Google's lunch. They're advertising lunch, because Google essentially controls most of the advertising on the internet. The way they're doing it is they're essentially blocking all the ads. They're serving their own ads, but you get paid for watching those ads. So like whatever ads are coming at you from this browser, you get paid in cryptocurrency. You get paid in this basic attention token. So you can choose how many ads you get, and you can choose what kind of ads you get. And if you do choose to look at them, you get paid. So they're trying to monetize your attention, which Google already has. They're just not paying you. Google just pays themselves. So there's very interesting technologies kind of being built on.
Would you consider that a kind of magical technology?
It is. I mean, you know, magic, even in like the most kind of basic way, like if you think of like magic tricks, is an attention trick, right? It's like it's paying attention to something specific or distracting you from something so you don't see that something else is happening. So Google, in a sense, is doing something very magical. It's like they're saying like, hey, we're going to give you the whole internet.
Mm-hmm.
But what, you know, don't look over here, because by doing this, we're also making a ton of money and you're our product. Even though we pretend that we're the product that we're giving you, you're actually our product. We're actually using your attention to make a lot of money. And this crypto project, this Brave browser, is trying to break that spell a little bit by saying, hey, you're already looking at ads, so why don't you just keep looking at ads, but we'll actually pay you for doing this. You're actually doing work. You're doing work by doing this. So we're going to pay you with this cryptocurrency.
We still don't have a thing. Maybe we do need to have a thing, just to sort of a sign-off thing.
Oh, a sign-off. Yeah, maybe we should have some kind of like nice way to calm down, like a little calming effect. Like may may find quiet now after we've
be with you.
After we've introduced so many conflicting thoughts into it.
Let's quiet the default network system down.
You're ready to shut down? Shut down. System. Ready to hit the shutdown button? Power off. Power off.
Power on.
Thank you.